Hello and welcome to Women's Wellness with Loose Inspiration. I am your host, Lucy Catino. Ladies, this is your safe space where we discuss everything women's wellness. Let's dive in and start to peel back the layers. My special guest today is Dr. Janice Johnson Dias. She holds a PhD in sociology from Temple University with a specialization in urban and political sociology. Now a tenured associate professor of sociology at John Jay, Janice is also president of the Grassroots Communication Community Foundation, a New Jersey-based training institution with a focus on public health and social action that she co-founded in 2011, which she quotes, "It is my life's work." We will be discussing tips on how to help teenagers cope with the anxiety around COVID-19. Welcome, Dr. Janice Johnson Dias. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling pretty good. I got my little 5 miles in this morning. I've had a little bit of writing, way too many meetings, but it's all right. It's a good
I
day.
love it. I love it. I'm loving the energy. You sound really upbeat, and we need that right now. So it
Yes.
seems like you're coping pretty well.
I'm doing pretty good, but I enjoy my family. I enjoy being, with them, and so that creates a real environment of joyfulness for me.
You
So
know, it really translates online, when I'm watching your photos and then also watching Scotty's photos. It's like, what you're saying is pretty accurate. So that's awesome. And it inspires me too to see that. And this is what this time is about. It's really about deciding what we will make of it,
Yes,
And
so much
so,
of it. Yeah.
yeah,
I
absolutely.
think more than anything for me this time is, are we going to close the gap on our values and our actions, right? Because a part of what happens is when we're typically in the hustle and bustle of life, we have all of these imaginary things that we say we're about. And now, in some respects, we have some time to attend to those things. So I love some of the memes that said, I always said if I worked from home, I would cook all my meals and or I would exercise more. And now that you do, you're like, oh, I now learned that that's a lie, right? It's just like we have to this I think this there's many opportunities and way too many challenges in this moment. But for me, in thinking about the opportunities, I think what this is an opportunity to kind of really shrink, if not erase, the gap between values and action.
I love that. I love that. And something we like to say too, just to bounce off of that is, I don't have time. If only I had time, I would write that book, or I would, or whatever. So it's so accurate. Wow, it's so beautiful that you said that. Now, we talk a lot about how we're coping as adults, loss of jobs or whatever the anxiety or the concerns may be, but seldom are we talking about our teenagers, our young ones. How are they coping with this new transition and in this new phase in their lives, So I wanted to bring you on to shine some light on some of these concerns. And two, as parents, how do we help them cope with some of their anxieties and concerns, or even posing a lot of mental health challenges at this time, right? So I'm just going to dive right in with my first question for you. I first wanted to talk about your grassroots organization, actually, because it actually has a lot to do with this conversation too that we're about to have. What inspired you to start Grassroots Community Foundation, and did you see a need that you wanted to address at that time?
It's funny because I am in the first really highly developed rounds of my book, and that was the outstanding question. That's where the book begins, by telling the story of like why and how does a person decide that they want to start an organization with this particular lens of public health and social justice. And for me, there has been a series of profound gaps around the different public health conversations. And the core gap that I've experienced is that oftentimes when we're thinking about our health and well-being, whether mental, physical, spiritual, or otherwise, and we are framing it in context of thinking about long-term health, we disassociate children and what is happening with them from what is happening with their adult parents or caregivers. And this, I mean, and it occurs so innocuously that often it goes unaddressed. So people will say, we have a childhood obesity problem. And not attending to the reality that, you know, adults control the access to food for children, and that children grow up to be adults. And some of the presenting problems in childhood also continue to adulthood. So in 2010, the United States, then under Barack Obama and his wife, Michelle Obama, launched the Let's Move initiative with this very specific goal in mind of reducing childhood obesity. And in the early presentation of this work, it was keenly focused on making sure that we reduce obesity, because at that point, 1 in 3 Americans were overweight and obese. This issue was really living and growing strongly in our children. And they launched a bunch of different efforts to address this. And the reported things and the actions they were going to do were going to deal with the structural issues that really affect, you know, children's health. They were going to, you know, they were going to impact what is happening in schools, because so many children get their food from schools, particularly poor children. They were going to pay attention to access to foods in neighborhoods, to address the food desert issues, et cetera. And absent from the conversation were parents. And it was just like super curious to me. And I was like, oh, they'll just get to it. But they never really got to it. And they never got to the relationship between food and mental health. They never got to the relationship between being obese and sexual health outcomes. And I had been doing research on these areas. And I was like, clearly, this is a smart administration. They have access to really brilliant people. While we don't know the causal order, right? Like, we don't know if somebody is depressed and they eat more, or they eat more and become depressed, right?
Right.
We know that. Academics haven't sorted out, but we were aware that, especially for white girls, for example, when they are overweight and obese, they have lower sexual capital, and their lower sexual capital puts them at risk for risky sex behavior, because compared to their non-overweight counterparts, they have to engage or think they have to engage in a set of actions so that they can become sexually appealing. So for Black girls and brown girls, that's not a problem. But for white girls, obesity increase their risky sex behavior. And so there were these unattended pieces around health and well-being that I felt was missing. And so I wanted to fill a gap that I felt like the First Lady of the United States has to consider, you know, the 68 to 70% of the population who are white, but obesity is a problem that lives in Black and brown community that largely resides with women and girls, and was an issue around poverty. And I already had a set of skills and talents that could attend to those things. And so I formed an organization with that focus in mind, to think about holistic health that did consider these kinds of current challenges, but recognizing that when we are fully healthy, even if we have periods like increase in childhood obesity, even a pandemic, is that a whole health self is more likely to buffer these problems than to think about our health in these discrete individual parts. And so that's what Grassroots aims to do. And it does so by taking a family-centered approach and connecting children to the caring adults around them as a way of saying, if we want kids' health to improve, we're going to have to make a keen investment in their caregivers, not just their parents, but their real care circle of people who are influencing their food, their thoughts, their ideas, and their behaviors.
Right, which is a community of people, not just your parents or, you know, your grandparents or whoever, like you said, your, yeah. So that's, I love that. Very, very important. So this organization serves the community. What community does it serve?
So it primarily, so we are located, our core office is located in New Jersey, and we serve five kind of groups. We serve elementary, middle, and high school girls through our summer intensive program called Super Camp, and through our year-round program called Supergirl Society. So that is a public health and leadership development academy. So we serve them and their caregivers in that mode. We also do a series of public health initiatives across the country in Memphis, Boston, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, et cetera, that is intended to help people who have been largely sedentary come together and train for and get their bodies moving. And we host an annual race, and it's really, I sometimes call it the Black race,
I love that.
because it is the largest kind of grouping of Black and Brown people running their first 5K. And we do it in a neighborhood that has been largely characterized as problematic. But for us, we see it as pregnant with possibility. And there's nothing like having, especially in this moment, having the physical, physically large numbers of Black and Brown people occupy the streets. And so for us, it both engages the idea that we are visible, we are seen, and we're healthy. And across in other cities, we have a thing called May Movement. May is Family Wellness Month. It's also Physical Activity Month, and it is Mental Health Awareness Month. And we have ambassadors in each of these cities that really come together and do weekly initiatives to get members of our community, again, who are usually sedentary, who are not in community with other people, to come together and form communities around movement, about connecting, et cetera. And then we do some sporadic, I call it sporadic, people say it's not sporadic, trainings for the general public. Often I'm called on by virtue of my networks to kind of have conversations that people don't have about skill development, girls' competency, and and confidence. And so over the past couple of years, I have put together these convenings called Think Faster, and the fast Think Fast and Think Faster, and it's FAST. It's Finance, Arts, Science, and Technology. Much of the dialogue we've been having across the country is about STEM and now STEAM. And yet the data evidence says and tells us that it's really finance, arts, science, and it's really the science of public health science, and technology are the fastest growing fields. And so while STEM clearly is true, the essence STEM and science, as we're learning in this moment, is really it's not the science of so much of computers, though that's valuable. It is this place of thinking about the fact that the healthcare industry is the largest growing industry in the world, and getting our kids trained during the summer and during the year. We have a partnership with RWJ Barnabas, New Jersey's largest healthcare system, and teaching our girls to have research literacy and public health literacy. So we try to attend to these different matters in certain ways. Now, what has happened with us over, I think, the last 5 years is we feel like the A team of public health. In the sense of, if you remember the A team from the 80s, it's like we're a small cadre of people and we're happy to help if you can find us. So sometimes people find us and ask us to remediate a situation. So for us right now, we have been engaged for the past, I guess, 3 or 4 years around trying to bring a different lens to the conversation around period poverty. And, there is a large national conversation about the fact that women and girls are being overtaxed by the federal government and state governments regarding sanitary napkins. So we have it's called a luxury tax, where we tax women and girls and menstruators in general for tampons and other sanitary items, but we don't tax condoms. We don't do any of those things. So 35 states in the United States doesn't have such has been taxing women, and we have been trying to marshal some energy around that across the globe. And even in our backyard here in New Jersey, girls are missing an average of 4 days each time their period occurs, because they don't have enough sanitary napkins. So we have provided over about 50,000 sanitary napkins to girls and menstruators in Newark, in Jamaica, and in Ghana. And we have built a pantry that provides not only food but sanitary items in Newark. We were en route to do one in Jamaica, and from leaving from Jamaica to Ghana to break ground, and then the pandemic occurred. So we have had to halt those efforts, and will continue to support organizations. Well, you know, like people are just like, well, you know, it's yours. And for us, our work, we really do mean that community in our name. Our work is about amplifying the efforts of others, working in relationship with others, and you know, sanitary napkins and menstruation issues are important to us, to the extent that if a girl doesn't feel good and is sitting in a wet pad or doesn't come to school, it influences her health and well-being. And we don't want that, because we know that an educated girl is a healthy girl, and has likely, if she chooses to have children, will have healthy children. And that's really vital to us. So we lend our efforts to these initiatives as people find us and try to, you know, we end up becoming the A team of a kind of public health and social justice work.
That's beautiful. Now, with the pandemic happening now, how are you able to still serve and kind of implement some of the,
These things.
these things?
So we are providing sanitary napkins and food to our local high school here in New Jersey. I am a couple of days overdue of bringing our girls some written cards and thank yous, and we bought masks for the sanitation staff at Newark Beth Israel Hospital in Newark, because you know, our girls each year have gotten received training. Newark Beth Israel is under the RWJ Barnabas system, and they have been so cordial to us. And you know, with so much happening and people really praising the efforts of our nurses, our firefighters, our police, our doctors, people who are cleaning up these biohazards and taking care of it are getting lost. And so we wanted to honor the people who are usually not seen. And we will continue to do that to make sure that we can attend to the maintenance and sanitation staff to the best of our ability. The other thing that we have done is we've done, again, some of these kind of emergency care organizations and people who have needed us in Newark and in around the country who have asked for families to be fed. We have provide and send groceries. But the biggest work, I think, for us that has been done is really with the families that we serve. And that is getting them informed, and training them in an ongoing basis about how to understand what is happening. My general concern is that I don't feel hurried to so much respond to the pandemic. And I feel much more hurried to make sure that people understand that this pandemic is a part of a larger set of systemic inequalities that really affects Black and Brown communities and disenfranchised and vulnerable people in a very particular way. And whether it's the pandemic or the next thing, we need a public health framework and a social justice framework, not only to make sense of it, but then to decide how we're going to respond and how we're going to inform and educate our children, which I know is a part of this conversation.
Yes, that's right. And so you have a book coming out early next year entitled Parent Like It Matters: How to Raise Joyful, Change-Making Girls. Now, tell us a little bit about the process in writing that and what inspired that and what you're hoping to teach parents and to, what message are you hoping to spread?
Well, I felt that I was bullied. I'm using the word bullied by my daughter. My daughter is Marcy Dias, and she started the 1,000 Black Girl Books campaign.
She sure
And
did.
she really bullied me into writing this book. I vowed I would never write a book. So, I have a PhD. You have to write a dissertation. Mine is some 300 plus pages. And, people always encourage you. I went on to the University of Michigan for my postdoc in public health policy. People just like, you need to turn this dissertation into a book. And I was like, I'm never writing a book, bruh. Like, there's no planet on which I am writing somebody's book.
Never say
And
never.
Boy, never. So here, fast forward, right? 13 years later, I have this daughter who has taken the world by
She
storm.
sure
And
is.
every time she goes and speaks, people are just like, well, how did your mom and your dad do it? And sometimes people will come up to me and Scotty, they'll cry on us, they'll ask us questions. And they were like, well, what'd you do? And I was like, I made her eat broccoli. And I would always be glib. Because each child is just so uniquely different. And I know that people wanted better answers from me. But like, I can low key be an asshole about when people want something from me that I don't want to give. And the tone of my voice allows me to just kind of have my kind of glib attitude to myself. But my general perception is that I don't believe in formulas around parenting. So I thought people were being really sweet, but at the same time, I was really very clear that I was rejecting anything that would say, do A plus B plus C, and you will get a girl who is on the Ellen show. Like that, no, bruh. So,
No, there is no formula to Marley.
there's no formula. So there's no formula for any kid. So
There isn't.
it kept happening more and more over the 4 years. And about a year and a half ago, Marley's like, Mom, really though? And I was like, really though? And I was like, I'm not Marley Dice. People were beating down her door to give her a book deal, right? Like, I'm her mom. And by virtue of allowing Marley to really speak her mind, people don't really know a lot about me, which is kind of dope. But more and more people started to scratch at the surface of like, who's the mom? And they started to like Google me and find out like, oh, the mom has a PhD for real, right? Like, and she has a job for real, and then grassroots, like, so people started to like scratch
Of course.
at who me and Scotty were. And I was like, oh no, we put her out here so y'all can hear from her. Because I was very concerned early on that so many children that I know in the public limelight, their voice is not independent. And I had made a career or a significant amount of money from being a public speaker. And if I spoke, while Marley was speaking, I was concerned that she would be seen as more of a puppet rather than independent.
Thinker, yeah, I get that.
So we really chose not to speak. So if you look up until years, we've only done one interview and one speaking gig together. And so I just really avoided it, even though I was always present. So people could see like I'm the person present with her, but not really articulating much. So Marley kind of came to me and urged me and urged me. And then Marley's literary agent was like, really, sis, what are you doing? And I was like, I don't even know if I could. Like all of a sudden, like all of my, like resolute positions started to like wane. I was like, could I even write a book though? Like, because anything I would want to write, I needed it to be in lay everyday people language. Because this is my beef with being an academic, is that we write for ourselves. And I publish a lot of academic articles. And even though sometimes I think of myself as being accessible, maybe I'm not that accessible. And so I was like, I'm not confident I could do it, right? If I said yes, I will at least try. But I got lots of support and encouragement, and people just gas you because they love you. And they're
Or
like,
they know you can actually do it too, you
hi,
know.
we can say anything we want to hear. So I wrote this proposal with lots of support, and then the agent sent it out, and a few people bid on it. And Ballantine at Penguin Random House gave a great bid, and I agreed to write this book. And the book is real combination of things. It is the 10-year experience of working with 60 girls and their families intensely in New Jersey, and also the 300 girls that have been a part of, and I didn't mention our after-school programs in Philadelphia, and what I have come to learn and understand about what it takes to make sure that we continue to cultivate a feeling of joy in our children, and also to connect their joyfulness to their change making. So
Yes.
fundamentally, the book takes a position, which I'm assume that many people will find accessible and frustrated and really unjoyful. And so
Yeah.
much of what my work, my daughter's work, the work of the foundation is about is joy as a beginning platform for advance and change making. And furthermore, the second big message in the book is that if we want joyful children, we are going to have to unburden ourselves from our own adult and childhood pains to cultivate a joy within us. Anything we want to see in our children, we must be in ourselves and model that for them. That the idea of do as I say, not as I do, in fact, is a message that feeds inequity and problems. And so I have a wealth of experience, and I'm an academic, a lot of research that really connects these idea that joyfulness and change making are linked, and that modeling and parenting is the ideal framework for healthy and just children. So that's what the book lays out, and it has a bunch of exercises and readings, and it's intended to really be like a book of recipes that you can pick up, you can open, you feel like, I can go to this chapter because it's meaningful to me. I can go to another one. So it's intended to be user friendly in every way.
Now, is it an exercise that you can do with your
It's
child,
all
or
of
is
the
it?
so all of the exercises are things that you can do with your children from very early on, and exercises that are designed for you. So the first portion of the book really focus on the truths that we understand about our children. The second portion really understands the way in which we can think about developing strategic and planful ways of engaging them and achieving balance within ourselves. And then the last section of the book, the third section, is really about what are the activities that you can do with your children so you see whether or not they're understanding this concept of social connectedness, community, justice, as they grow. So it's a book that can really grow with caregivers and with children. So you can start these exercises, the ones that are directed towards you, if you're pregnant or if you just had a child, and then as your child grow, there are exercises that you can do with her along the way up until she is, off to college or traveling the globe or whatever it is that children do when they get old enough to leave home.
Yeah, whatever it is, they do a lot. That's awesome. That's so great. I love that. You've taken an actionable approach to, sharing your wisdom. And I think, wow, I actually cannot wait to read it. We have teenagers here too. It's things that we can really apply. So I'm excited for it. Now, you are raising a strong change maker yourself, your daughter Marley. What advice or maybe encouragement you would have for a parent raising their daughters in today's society? What would
You
you
cut out a
say is
little
like
bit.
the
I don't know if
main
you're aware.
thing? Oh no, I wasn't. What advice or words of encouragement would you give to a parent raising a daughter in today's society?
Yeah, I think that my advice always begins with the caregiver. I think, and this is a little bit of a truncation, know yourself, know who you are, parent, exercise humanity as a parent. And I'm really glib about that. I am deeply concerned that caregivers in general are inhumane to themselves and do not allow themselves the range of emotions, thoughts, ideas, are not joyful, and they raise children expecting them to be something else. So my first advice is, parent, know thyself. And then my second advice is a very simple one, is parent the child you have, not the child you desire to have.
Profound.
Because, it's hard sometimes, I think, for folks to see their children for who their children are.
We have these
We've made up
expectations,
like
you
this
know.
whole thing. And so, and it's super unjust to the kid. And so get to know the child you have, and parent that child in a way that allows that child to meet his or her highest potential as defined by that child. And that I think is super hard for folks, is like, so you really want me to raise a kid to be what that kid wants to be versus what I've decided the kid is going to be. Yeah, that's actually really my supercharge to people, is that imagine raising liberated people.
Imagine that. I mean, as an adult, I even think back, well, didn't I always want to be liberated and free? Didn't I always want to be who I am here to be? So, I mean, we have to think about that, really. I mean, that's what we
That's
all
all we all want. But
want.
the thing is, when you first say it, it sounds super hokey because children don't know a lot. So, right? So I think what I want to make sure parents hear is that you're still guiding, you're still determining the rules, you're still doing a host of things. You let a child wake up and be like, wake up whenever you want to, do whatever you want to, just be, right? Like, so I think people miss what I like about the book that I'm writing is that freedom is not guidance free, and people can raise children that have a lot of guidance, a lot of supervision, et cetera, and can be humans, that we can really raise humane, just, joyful children.
Yes, and that's a beautiful balance. I love that. Now, in this stressful time that we're in with, facing the pandemic, how do we help and assist teenagers at this time? How do we address to their needs and their concerns, and they're trying to figure it all out while we're all trying to figure
So,
it out all out? What are you doing in your
well, I'll tell you
household?
what I'm doing. I think there are a couple of things. My daughter is 15 and she is on social media and she is connected to friends. And so she's getting a host of information that is not coming through me, right? So the interesting part about this conversation is a lot of my book is really about these kind of early years. But, like once a child is a teenager, you get less, governance out of how information makes its way to them. So I think the first thing that parents have to, of teenagers, right? Because you could have a teenager and a young child, but of teenagers, is that you want to ensure them that you are informed by becoming informed, right? So you want to make sure that you are providing your young people with accurate and reliable information as you know it. And that means you have to become highly informed and good consumer of the information that is coming across your phones, your televisions, your social media. And that's a responsibility. So in this moment, more than any other moment, we need parents to be good consumers of information and to become informed parents. When parents don't understand, because there's a lot that parents don't understand, they should seek out clarification because that clarification is going to help them translate and talk to their teenager. They also must ask their teenager, what they are hearing and understanding about the information they have access to. So, for example, there's information about the pandemic on TikTok. I, James Johnson, am not on TikTok, but my daughter and my, I think my husband are on TikTok. I don't know what that information looks like, right? But she does. So really important is that we talk about what she's seeing and hearing every day. Because if I don't know what she's seeing and hearing, then I have no way of connecting to her and potentially correcting any errors or suggesting an alternate course of action, right? That's so right. That, I think, is being informed is really good for one's mental health. Mm-hmm. And people undervalue this all the time because information allows us to consider alternative possibilities. And that's in right. a moment where science is so critical to our understanding is that science demands that we deal with ambiguity. And what I am seeing generally on all of the media that I'm associated with is a refusal to consider ambiguity as an important part of this process. It's called the novel coronavirus. Novel meaning we have no idea. It is new to us. It's not a book. It's That's new right. to us. And a learning virus means that all of us have to learn, and errors in our understanding is a part of the process. So our children, our teenagers need to know that. Now, they're going to be ill-equipped if we have been authoritarian or dogmatic. They're used to things being one way or another way. Mm-hmm. And so this is a moment where we'll begin to see that, because they might be asking questions like, when is this going to be over? Right?
Yes. I hear that a lot. And
if we haven't been in the experience of saying, well, there's a likelihood, or I'm unclear at this moment, let me think about it before I get back to you. I don't know either. If we haven't been introducing conditional, right, things in our vocabulary with our parenting, then those kids are going to be feeling all out of sorts. You're supposed to know. And here is a moment when nobody knows.
Yes.
And as a parent, you now have to show them, right, that you are a human being capable of not knowing and having some anxieties yourself. Now, you cannot demonstrate to your young person who requires your guidance the high level of anxiety that you might actually feel. You do have to first attend to yourself and your own anxiousness, and then provide comfort for them and safety for them. But that comfort will not come if you feel like you don't know anything.
So does the comfort look like this? Open communication, constant checking in, asking how they're feeling?
I think sometimes the comfort sometimes looks like not talking about it, right? Like you should not be talking about the virus every day in your house. I do not recommend that.
Yes.
Like that, no. Like that can't feel good. Right?
No. You know? No, it's true. Yeah, because then it's like, oh my goodness, this is really happening at every second.
So I'll tell you what we do in this house. So Scott is the smartest person in the house. It's really disruptive that he's so smart, because he is the laziest person in this house. He's going to hear this so he can hear this, right? But
well, I'll make sure I send him this episode.
So he's the smartest person. And he's always consumed like 5 or 6 newspapers every morning before everything. I am the least bright person in this house, but I use up, the way I describe it is that I have the least, but I use up 100% of it. Scott has the most, and he uses up maybe 0.6%, right? So and then Marley ends up being this hybrid between us, clearly smart like her dad, maybe articulate like me, but just like wicked. So it's a wickedly smart household. And so, and Marley's emotional intelligence is high,
which is great.
Which means that she can sense the anxiousness in us if we're anxious, right?
Yes.
So that's like, that's a little irritating in this moment. It's generally fine, but she knows when we're fronting. So we really have to get control of ourselves. So on an everyday basis, we keep a routine. 11 o'clock is bedtime for the good people of this house. right? Like everybody gotta go to bed. Everybody must eat breakfast. The breakfast must be a hot breakfast. We're not playing those games. I
Nice.
am so Caribbean, right? You need hot food in your belly. And so we have to
Yep.
have that. We also all need some physical activity. Nobody gets to get out of physical activity because physical activity is good for our brain. Right, like I can't, y'all can't get dumb on me because you never used up a lot anyways, right? And so everybody's got to find a way to engage with physical activity. Now, Marley's not so much about the outside. She does her 30 minutes and push-ups and sit-ups and whatever. Scott, again, is the laziest. So, but he's happy to build something outside, be outside with the dog, do all the rest of those things. And I work, that's the first thing I do in the morning is I get at least 30 minutes of movement, run, walk, weight training, whatever. So that hasn't changed. And I'm actually at day 139 of doing at least 1 mile every single day without interruption. So physical activity is really central. And then each day, each person must find a way to do something that makes them joyful. So I really demand that of my family. And I don't care if you paint, I don't care if you talk to your friend, but everybody every day has to do that. And there can be
And now, is this something you do collectively, or you just
you have
do you do your
So
own
Marley
thing?
and Scott do a lot of stuff together because I'm in the middle of edits and the semester just ended for me a day ago. So they'll play volleyball. They will do a dance routine, but you have to break for a joyful moment. This is not
I
like
love
if you
that.
do not break, and I'm so hostile about joy. Like it's so funny because I'm like, what'd you do today to make yourself feel good? And they're like, what? Right?
That's
Like
right.
you must do something that make yourself feel good. Like you must do it. And that's it's easier for Marley, harder for Scott. Really important for me. Like I watch a movie every single day. Like don't play, right? like
Well, that's your
that
joy,
that's me.
and you've been able to identify
Yes,
that. That's
and
awesome.
I forced them, right? Like Mother's Day, I made them watch my favorite movie, which was so long, The Color Purple, and we're all here
Oh,
crying,
yeah,
right?
jeez.
But it those things are routines. So they are routinized. So for me, routines allow you to build anchors. And
Yes, that's what I'm hearing.
routine,
Routine,
but not so artificial that it has no room for flexibility and for adjustment. It's just that the security of knowing in a moment of not knowing, right? You know there will be dinner. You know that you will laugh today. You know that you will move today. What are the things that you know for sure? And make sure that children always feel like there are things they know for sure. And there are some things like when this will end, what will happen to school, that they don't know for sure. But there are some things that they know for sure. And those things are not just the love of their parents or caregivers, that these are the things that we're going to do. I know tomorrow we're going to have breakfast. I know tomorrow I'm going to have to come up with a workout routine. I know tomorrow, like it just stabilizes and reduces uncertainty. And all of the evidence that we have says that that helps them feel safe in many moments. And then we take moments of break, right? So, like, we here have real breaks. Like, Scotty likes to get in the car and drive with the dog with his head out the window. So, we'll join him to just do a drive because, you know, we can't go anywhere. So, we might as well go nowhere together.
Exactly. And get some air.
Yes.
I mean, this it's so important to get out and get some fresh
So I
air,
think for teenagers, most of it is what you built before. If you haven't built a strong communication with a teenager before, which is difficult, I find teenagers to be special in every way. I feel like I have a lovely, challenging teenager.
That's a great word for them. Special. I really like that. I'm gonna steal that one. That's
Right,
perfect.
like they're so. I mean, because and I get it, right? Like I totally get it. Like you don't know if you're an adult or you're a child. You're trapped in the.
It's very awkward. It's an awkward phase. It really
Like in the
is.
purgatory of adulthood, right? Like it's just like whatever. So, you know, sometimes my child is a sweet girl like she was when she was 9, and sometimes she's an asshole. And so I'm like, whatever, right? But I have built in a lot of flexibility. Was like, I get it. Sometimes I want to be an asshole too. And so, bet, let's just hope that your asshole day and mine are not also
Don't
on
clash.
Tuesday, right? Right?
Exactly. That is so
I'm
accurate.
lying. But I am really clear that parents of teenagers need to really start being honest, which is like my daughter. And this is a horrible parenting story. So, but I will share it because I really think it's important that people understand what I mean by humanity. So, a couple of nights ago, my daughter was throwing up, right? Her dad was up and he was attending to her. She ate something poorly and she threw up, and I was asleep. And Scotty was clearly up and taking care of her. And so she comes nonetheless and knocks at my door and is like, "Mom, I'm throwing up." And I was like, "Okay, where's dad?" And she's like, "Dad's been here the whole time." I was like, "Good, please close my door on the way out." And
At least you have one parent. That's okay. You'll be
I was like,
fine.
so the next morning they both have jokes like, "You're like, oh, I gotta get my sleep." And I was like, "Look, y'all play games with your life. You really think that you really need two parents to attend to this throw up? You
I
do not."
know.
And
Seriously.
I was tired because I'm still teaching 170 students. And I was like, "You are gonna forget this one important thing, maybe now, but you're gonna remember it. Parents are human too. And some of
Oh,
us."
geez, really? Are we? I really, for
Yeah.
real?
And we allow ourselves to not behave like humans. And so our children are always like aghast, like, "Oh my God. So, like, you need your sleep?" Yeah. I need my sleep. I need my sleep. I
That's
need my
right.
time by myself. I need to not know what you're doing. You think I need to know what you're doing? I only need to know what you're doing to the extent that you don't harm yourself. I actually don't
Yeah,
care
this
about your
is
life
true.
like that. My life is really interesting too. You want to hear what me and my friends were talking about?
Exactly. Which they're like, oh no,
Yeah.
they're well, I've all of a sudden their schedules become really full. So yeah, I get that. But that's I'm glad you did share that because we
You cut
do
out
need to
again.
remember
I'm sure
that.
you'll edit
Oh,
this.
I will. So I was saying I'm glad that you did share that because it's we do need to be reminded that parents are
But
humans
we have
too.
to behave like
So
humans. And I think that
yeah,
it's not
we
our
do.
children's fault. It's not Marley's fault. The reason why Marley came into my room is because for so many years, she had us on her beck and call. And the transition from like mom will be sleep deprived, food deprived, whatever, to attend to my needs. She had so many of those moments that it's an expectation. So what do you do in a pandemic? Right? So like, we can't expect her. There'll be many more of those instances where she's expecting the mom of a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old or a 9-year-old to attend to a 15, 16-year-old. That mom is no more, right? So your parenting has to accommodate the children at the age they are, but it cannot do it without open dialogue. So for me, the thing that I reinforce in my book, I reinforce in my training, is that so much of our own, especially those of us who are in our 30s, 40s, and 50s, so much of that is we captured things through seemingly osmosis. Our parents did a thing, we learned from it, it wasn't articulated. These children demand articulation and explanation. And so we have to build a way of explaining to them what is happening. Now that you're older, this is what I'm expecting. Not one day just flip out on them like, "Don't you see the dishes? What are my now new responsibility? I am not aware. You've always washed the dishes. Why is today the day that I'm now required to wash the dishes?" Right?
No, yeah, and that's so it's such a great point right there. Like you have to be able to communicate with them. Well, this is the transition. This is the new change. So that way they're not just, oh, wow, where is this coming from? I think with any relationship, right? That's something we kind of owe that to each other,
We owe
right?
it, and this does not happen in friendships, and it certainly doesn't happen in marriages, which is like, people ask me, 20, yeah, I guess Scott and I've been together 22 or 23 years. And people are like, well, how have you
Wow.
guys endured? In large part is I am not the person Scott married. Let's be clear, right? He married
Yeah,
a
you can't
much
be.
sweeter person than this person. And he is not the man I married, but we grew differently, staying and keeping the core values in the same. I think it's the same thing with teenagers. So this moment is a hard moment. You have to talk to them about the fact that this is a hard moment. They're not imagining it, right?
No.
And you also have to talk to them about how you're feeling and how they're feeling. And then you develop together ways of responding. Now, my daughter has therapy online weekly, right? And so she's able to see a therapist through our healthcare, right? Because I have employee healthcare. She's able to talk to a therapist, and that helps her. And so she has my communication, her dad's communication, together communication, a therapist communication. But the first 4 weeks, she wouldn't talk to any of her friends. And I was like, Mar, what are we doing? And she was like, oh, everybody's probably busy. And I was like, you have to reach out to your friends. And I hear from several parents that some kids don't want to talk to their parent, their friends because they fear that they're going to miss them more. And so, because our national stupidity has led to the term social distancing versus physical distancing, we have some young people who are like, well, I guess we've just got to socially distance ourselves from our friends. I was like, no, this is the time for social connectivity and physical distancing and forming and being in relationship with people, connecting with people. This is the moment you lean in, not isolate. And so teenagers need to be reminded that there are friends that they have, people that they care for, the grandmas, the aunties, the people who always send the birthday presents, that they can be much more connected to in this moment than in previous moments, so that they feel like they have an anchor, and a community of people who will keep them reminded of the things that are normal to them as the whole world becomes not normal.
Profound. I mean, I'm just speechless beyond. This has been amazing. Your wisdom, and also thank you for sharing your personal journey at this time, because I feel like that's a real way for people to connect, and you're giving us actionable tools that we can implement if it fits your lifestyle. So I really do appreciate your time. This has been amazing. Please do let us know where we can stay in
So you
touch.
can find me. I am on Instagram, which is one of my favorite platforms, at Dr. Janice Johnson, because I get to be ridiculous. And I can also be found at the grassrootscommunityfoundation.org. So that's grassrootscommunityfoundation.org. For anyone who's listening, who's kind of interested in my academic work, John Jay College of Criminal Justice is where I teach. And there's a whole platform that leads up, that will give you the whole bio and the things that I've written about as it relates to mothers and children and mental health. But in general, if you're on Facebook, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter. Twitter feels hostile to me, so I really only go to that space sometimes.
Same, same.
But Instagram and my DMs, I don't have anyone creeping in my DMs. So if you write me a message, I'll actually see it and read it and respond. I'm fairly responsive. And I, for me, every time anyone wants to reach me, I always say you can just Google grassroots or you Google Janice Johnson Dias. And I believe in connection. Connections make my life good. And so please feel free. I'm happy to answer and do what I can to support the health and well-being of our community, and especially of the dyads of moms and children out there.
That's right. Beautiful. Now, before I let you go, I like to dive even deeper with three additional questions, okay? So I'm going to start with my
All right.
first one. If you, Dr. Janice Dias, were to write yourself a love letter, how would that begin?
So dear Janice,
Hello.
I believe in a salutation.
Exactly.
Remember that the things that you don't like are the things that make you who you are.
Wow. Yeah. That's deep.
Yeah.
That's deep. I love that. Second question. What is your personal why? That one thing that gets you going every day?
So since I was very, very little, I always dreamed that if people were happier themselves, they would be kinder to others. And the reason why people were unhappy or people were so mean is because they didn't have the resources that they wanted to have. And so what is always happening for me is trying to figure out how to help people identify what they need and figuring out how I can be a conduit to help them get it. Because I struggle when I see people being unkind and unjust to others. And I really feel like it comes from a place of being under-resourced.
Wow. That's very true. I do agree with that. Beautiful. Lastly, what would you like to leave behind when this journey is over?
For me, I would really like to leave a really joyful, self-actualized daughter. When I think about, because, you know, I'm almost 50, so now people ask you all the time about what's your legacy. When I think about my legacy is I want to change the conversation about leadership strongly. And I get that more and more. I'm beginning to put more and more words to it. I want us to stop praising people who are fundamentally not joyful and seeking them out to be our leaders. I want us to have healthy leadership at every level of our lives. I no longer want to see parents who are like, my kid is getting all straight A's and the parent is sick, diabetic, crazy, whatever the case may be. I no longer want mayors and city council officials and presidents of the United States who are clearly unwell. And people are like, well, but they do this great thing. I don't want to praise and celebrate people who are marginalized, small people without being holistically healthy. I want us to fight for and choose healthy leadership at every level in our lives.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely accurate. I love that. I so, so agree with that. Well, this conversation has truly brought me so much joy. I can't even, I mean, from the beginning to the middle to the very end, thank you for brightening up my day and thank you for all the work that you're doing. And it's been an absolute honor to have this conversation with you today and keep being amazing and raising Marley the way that she is. I mean, your family is just phenomenal.
Well, thank you, Dr. Janice. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. I am really, really delighted that you asked me and invited me to do this. I mean, you know, you never know what you're going to say until you're asked the question. And I appreciate you taking such, asking me such great questions that I'm sure I'm going to talk to Marley and ponder for the next couple of days. You have a great day.
Absolutely. You do the same. And I'm really looking forward to the book too. I know I can get a lot of value out of it as well. We'll be in touch.
You have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye. And to my listeners, remember, you are the most important person in your life. Be well. And do check us out on our Instagram page. That's luce.inspiration, where I post new episode updates, inspirational quotes, my personal journey, and so much more. Sending you all so much love. Thank you.